PHP Radio
on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network,
your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.
Hello, you golfing legends, and welcome back to another episode of the Original Off Course. I'm your host, Dan Edwards, and joining me this week is one of the most electric accents in all of golf. He's a Walker Cup legend, but we know him from the show before. His name's Gavin Deer. He's with ShotScope, and Gavin, it is great to have you back.
No, I appreciate it. Always enjoy the chats, and yeah, good to catch up.
Awesome. Hey, first and most important question, which everyone wants to know, because it's the question that needs to be answered by you of all people. Are you playing any golf?
I am. So a couple of things have happened this winter. Obviously, we'll have the LM1. We'll talk about that. But that has meant that I've hit more balls this winter than probably the 5 or 8 years prior added up. And then in the last week, I have played 4 games of golf. Now, people will confuse that with then, therefore, you're playing well. I played on Sunday afternoon at Monifieth Links course. It was beautiful here for March, and my arms felt disconnected from my body. I was all over the place. So I am playing a lot of golf. The standard was pretty good up until Sunday, and it sort of nosedived into oblivion.
Wow. So you're kind of using muscle memory up until that point. Now you've over golfed and now things are confused.
Pretty much. It just kind of walked off and I went, I don't know what's happened there for 18 holes. I was just everywhere. One left, one right. Kind of managed the ball around okay, but it's been enjoyable. I've been out to Florida a couple of times, PGA Show, another trip out in Florida in February, played a bunch of golf. I'm like, wow, I've been hitting balls like every second day here through the winter. This is easy, you know, hitting it well. And then, Sunday was kind of back down to earth.
Wow. That's, maybe disappointing is not the right word. It's almost satisfying to hear someone of your skill and potential has a little hiccup. I've been having that same disconnect for about 5 years with my driver. So I wish I could say it was just last Sunday. But it's been a little bit hectic for me as well. I'm curious how when you say good weather, we all have different perspectives on that. In Ohio, good weather in March is sort of miserable and windy when it feels like being windy. What's good weather there for March?
So we had 3 days of good weather in March, and that was last week at the weekend. So the sun was out. It would have been maybe 60 degrees and it was blowing 20, but like it was okay. I mean, my main things are, is it going to rain? Mm-hmm. If it's going to rain, I'm pretty much not interested. The wind is less of a factor, but it's saying that on Tuesday we were meant to play St. Andrews and it was blowing 40, and I was like, guys, I have no interest, but it's up to you. So
you are a person who knows that wind well, and I know we will talk about your product, I promise.
But no. We'll chat about wind all you want.
So we've had some crazy winds here as well. I feel like I'm more tolerant of the wind when it's like 30 than I am when it's 10. It's almost like it gets to a certain threshold. I'm like, all right, now it's just goofy golf. Who cares? Let's just go have a good time. So 2 weeks ago, it was extremely windy, and I laughed our way around the golf course. It's just like, it's fun, it's different, it's weird. Once it's like in between that 10 and 15, like more like those little gusts, and it just enough to get your ball a little bit, that's where I get really irritated. What are you like when the wind varies that way?
So wind is obviously very weird in that, yes, you've got the different speeds and the effect it has, but then you also have the locations. So a coastal wind in Scotland is like a thicker wind. It will move the ball a bit more than maybe inland Scotland. But then if you go to Florida, it's warm air, balls go straight through it almost. So there's that kind of side of it. If you like, I can go back to my amateur days when you're playing a big links course and it's blowing 40. And it is just, can I get to the end? Can I keep the same ball that I started with? Can I keep the same ball that I started the hole with? You know, and it is just a battle. And I'm not, I used to love the battle. And I'll go and grind it out if I have to try and grind it out. And these days you're like, hey, I'm taking the time out to come play golf. I'd like a 10 mile per hour, a nice little breeze. Don't want the day to get too warm. I like to get shorts on, like to see the sun, you know, and then I can play golf from that point. I can't, must be getting old. Can't deal with sort of 40 mile per hour crosswinds and sort of cut sideways rain. No interest. Yeah.
Well, the rain certainly ruins the day for sure, especially when the wind's added. But I don't know, man. I used to hate the wind. I hit such a high ball with lots of spin. And over the years, I've controlled the spin a lot with irons better. And it's like, okay, I can actually now go and hit a shot and my four iron doesn't balloon at 150 or whatever the number ends up being. So it does become a bit more entertaining. But listen, I check two things when I look at the forecast, degrees and wind.
Yep.
the rain's like an added bonus, I guess, for me. So that's interesting. You mentioned the different types of wind depending on where you are. I've never really put a lot of thought into that, but like a warmer wind versus a colder wind, I don't think I've ever paid any attention to that.
Yeah, we used to talk about it quite a lot in college. There were a couple of from Scotland, and you know, but way back in the day, used to caddy. And you used to see it all the time. We used to get Americans over at Carnoustie. You stand in the first hole, and it's like, okay, well, it's a pretty strong wind here. I'd say it's three clubs. No, that's a one club wind. Like, hey, you're from Georgia. Watch this. Next shot, 65 yard pitch from in front of the green. So it's certainly, look, it's what makes the game part of your skill set, right? Evaluating the wind and evaluating your shot shape and how you hit it and the spin rate and how that's going to be affected by the wind and that type of wind. So yeah,
that's pretty fun. Tell me about, well, I guess you've it's been a while since you've been on the show, so I can't really say just tell me about this and that, but I think a lot of the conversation around shot scope this year started really at the PGA show. You guys came in hot, you had a whole great crew with you, and a couple products really shook up the conversation, which is a lot of fun. Both are well known at this point. People have talked about it pretty aggressively. We got a launch monitor that looks unbelievable for the price point, as well as a handheld, which looks really cool. There, you know, you've got a lot more in your category and your product line than you had the last time we talked. So I guess the question would be for you, if we want to start at the PGA show or talk about overall the last year and how things have gone for ShotScope.
Yeah, I mean, look, so 2025 for us was great in terms of we built upon 24, which was US retail, building those relationships, getting various products and SKUs into the mix. You know, I think when you look at UK, a lot of purchases are online, whereas in the US, it's very much in-store. A great experience when you walk into a US golf store, right? You know, your big box stuff, but even your smaller independent stores, they're a great experience there. So we knew we needed to do that. So built upon those relationships in 25, adding a variety of products and building out that team as well, because the team's really important to back it up and provide the service. And then, you know, we're always developing in-house and always looking at where there are gaps in the market and where we think we can have an effect and where we can add value for golfers and ultimately our users. And so sort of coming into the PGA show, it's weird. We were out there, for us, we do a lot of retail meetings September, October in the US. So we're out there and the LM1 was a bit of a kind of slide in a presentation. And we had just started doing some early testing. And I kind of sort of sort of in the corridor, I was like, you know, to some of the bars, like, you need to be pay attention to this one. Like, this one is very, very good. I've hit enough balls over my life to know what it's giving me back in terms of feedback. It's good. But again, it's a piece of paper. So we knew going into the PGA show that it would be interesting from that point. And it kind of put us out a little bit out of position because we really didn't know where that ultimately that demand would be. And it just went nuts. And, you know, we've been to the PGA show 10 years as a company. I've never seen that. What's fascinating is we had a couple of guys that hadn't been to the US before and were coming to their first PGA show event. And they're like, is this how it is every year? I'm like, no, this is not how it is. You know, and you're just trying to manage it all. And the more you talk to everybody, you go, okay, we've hit upon something here. And you know, with the launch monitor, we knew that when you go into the market, you could see where the market was in the various price points, and we would be lower than that. But it is much more basic than what a $500 or $600 launch monitor is providing you, right? So that's fine. But when you went and spoke to some of the store assistants, the guys that are out selling these launch monitors at $500, $600, and saying, look, I don't enjoy selling these products, because ultimately the golfer comes back after 2 weeks and starts quizzing me on it because they don't understand what that product's giving them. You go, okay, there's a usability challenge in launch monitors, and there's a simplicity of what do we actually need to know? And I think the LM1 fills both of those, and it widens up somebody that may have thought, well, I hit balls, but I don't have any feedback. Well, that LM1 provides that feedback loop. And then additionally, it brings them into the shot scope ecosystem as well. And I like to think we do a really good job of sort of taking care of all the users and ultimately giving them content or whatever it is to try and help them improve their game. So yeah, it's been a long few months.
Well, I guess I think it's natural at this point to talk purely LM1 because, you know, it instantly becomes the start of the conversation. I think the PGA show provided that a lot. There was all kinds of these, hey, you need to pay attention to this product. Hey, look at this thing that we found. And, you know, I want to be the first one, and instantly gets onto social media in every form. So that's a good thing, but it's also like, what are we looking at? And I think you made a couple of really interesting points when it comes to personal launch monitors, because we now have access to, as golfers, especially those who have brick and mortars near us, and not to mention the whole new category of golf, which is simulator golf, which is becoming more and more common. There's a combination of understanding and expectation that comes with the exposure to these products. And when it comes to a personalized unit, I don't think a lot of people out there are queued up to purchase a $15,000 unit. So suddenly they're looking for something that makes more sense to them, both from a practicality standpoint and a functionality standpoint. And then it's like the race to best value, right? So you have an infinite number, however many number of units in between the lowest price point and the mid price point or whatever it may be. But I think the question always comes back for me, and I've heard this question asked to me numerous times this year: what numbers do you need? What numbers can we provide to you in a unit that gives you the outputs you're looking for without making you feel like you've left something behind? So I'll circle back to you since we're now deep into the LM1. What was the starting point on numbers generated, and what did you feel like were reasonable concessions or critical additions to that component?
So it was actually probably simpler than a discussion on that. So we, you know, as I said, we're looking at gaps in the market, and we're trying to understand launch monitors, and we've got a variety of things in the pipeline. And we weren't building an LM1. We were playing about with bits of technology that our guys were coming up with, and how we could go and track balls and do a variety of things. And the LM1 almost fell to us. And it came from, you know, our guys are great in here of, we've got some tech. It doesn't look like an LM1, but we've got some tech. Go along to the driving range. We've got one that's a mile and a half away from the office. We've got a team full of golfers. Go and hit some balls. Give us some feedback on that little piece of technology. Go and take some things out and compare it against it. And it more just came out that the guy started enjoying using what was going to be the LM1. And we're sitting in an office and you're hearing things like, it was simple, easy, really enjoyed that. Hit balls, I want to see if I can go and hit balls again with it in a couple of days. And therefore, it was never more than it needed to be. And it was never cut back to make it what it is. It just appeared as that device. Whereas a lot of times, you know, we're sitting with a product and you could take the H50 and go, well, to do shot tracking. Well, how's it going to do shot tracking? We'll need to come up with it. Whereas the LM1 just went, actually, we think we can do this really, really well. Let's just make it that. And then there was a big discussion internally about, well, should it connect to the app or should it not? And ultimately we decided, yes, we should allow somebody at that price point to come in, store their sessions, analyze their sessions, understand on course to off course if they want to. But it never, we were never trying to do anything more than what it is for that device, which is fascinating that that's what it became. And maybe that's one of the reasons that it's done so well and appealed so well, because it was actually sitting there and you're going, well, you're not trying to add two more things in it. You're not trying to overcomplicate it. You're just going, actually, we just quite enjoyed this. And because it's so easy to use, and I joke about, if I get to the range, it takes me longer to put my glove on than it does to set the LM1 up to use. So, and then there's also a thing when we've been practicing, and I've been practicing a lot with it over the winter, and it's changed forms and we've added and we got it to exactly how we want it to look like. I couldn't go an hour at the driving range hitting balls without four or five people stopping me and asking me what I was using. And so you were almost, as we were sort of testing and refining the product, you were getting a verification from the customer of, that's really interesting. How much will it be? What else does it do? What is it? So it's almost just appeared that way. And then all of a sudden you get to the PGA show and you go, and it goes boom. And there's a massive interest level, both from media, people coming onto our booth, the industry, but then the Hackers Paradise forum as well. So you're starting to see, okay, wait a minute, there's an appeal here. And PHP is great from that point of view, because it's a variety of golfers. You know, there's some guys that are on THP that have the $15,000 home simulator system. Then there's guys that are like, well, I just hit balls once a week. And I think that's great because there's nothing else to track. So it just, it's kind of come from all angles just to be what it is without being overbuilt, which is quite cool in a way. Because I think that bogs down a lot of companies and a lot of product development.
Let me ask you a pretty loaded question that you might not be ready to answer. Does LM1 stand for Launch Monitor First Edition, or does it stand for the base model?
So, not sure. It's the best answer. I mean, look, that's where the guys at the Tracker Championship are always in for a treat. So open up the whole thing to show them what's coming next year. And not only that, they get this year's editions of products, and then they will get any products we're talking about as well. You know, we always do that. So for instance, the guys that were at Victoria National last year, they're just getting LM1s and H50s sent out to them just now. We're definitely not done with launch monitors, I would say. But I think what we come out with now will be vastly different to what is the LM1.
It's not going to rival an LM1. It's not going to be there. But I think we will have other things come out in the future.
I appreciate this approach, this idea that you don't start from the top and work your way down. You start from the most simplified, most viable, useful product and maybe potentially work your way up from there. It's not common. And I've had many conversations with golfers who, both on THP and off THP, who are tech curious, but not the kind of people that are going to go and spend 6 hours at a range trying to refine their golf swings. And what I think is important to note there is we've not only had conversations as to what launch monitor would work for them, we've also had conversations of, if I were to buy some sort of technological device, should I get a data tracking software for golf course use? Should I get a handheld GPS? Should I get a launch monitor? What is, if I were to buy one piece of golf tech this year, what should it be? Like, those are the types of conversations I'm having with everyday golfers. So I feel like once you get to a certain price point, you don't have to make all those concessions. It's like, hey, you know, maybe you can buy a couple pieces that solve your golf game throughout your goals, rather than picking one and isolating it, whether it's on course or on the range. I think that's incredibly curious.
Yeah. And it's fascinating because a lot of people go, well, who's the LM1 for? Well, ultimately, it's for anybody that hits golf balls. That doesn't really matter if you're on a grass range or you hit golf balls in your net in your back garden. You can still use an LM1. I mean, a couple of weekends ago, I had my daughter who's 7 at the driving range. And with the LM1, everybody will have seen the 5 numbers, but you can actually blow up so there's just one large number on the screen. So we just put total distance on it. And she just sat and hit 50 balls. And as a 7-year-old, you know, there's times where she gets bored. There's all of that, you know, she wants to take a break. She just hammered through 50 balls, checking how far she could hit it. And you go, so great. There's a use there, but that value is, because of the price, because of the usability, you can see value to numerous different groups of golfers.
That is such a funny point. Different sport, but my son's inside at a baseball practice last week, and they had the hit tracks, which is a pretty popular thing in baseball. And all the boys were hitting. They didn't care what their coach was saying. Every one of their little eyes were straight on the monitor, seeing how far they could hit it on the hit tracks each time. It's like, you're taking away that practice component and replacing it with something to chase. And I think that's a really interesting point. And it's not like it's just kids that do that. I mean, grumps will do the same thing. Like, avid golfers will do the same thing. They'll chase a number, which is a really funny point, because I just saw a perfect example of that in a different scenario. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what it is. It, again, for, you know, hitting balls, there'd be times there's 3 or 4 of us hitting balls, and I just get, I've hit a lot of balls. I'm going to see how quickly I can swing a driver. I'm like, I don't need to be doing that, but here I am, 25 balls. Give it everything you've got. So it's fascinating. It's also fascinating for us as a company, because we have been on course the whole time. So when you look at product cycles and you look at sales planning and forecasting for a year, well, everything we do is based on course. You know, rises in March and April and peaks in sort of June and then falls away down to October and then rises for holiday season. And we're looking at the LM1 going, well, okay, I see loads of guys using it through the summer, but surely, you know, when that winter kicks in for most golfers in the sort of northern hemisphere, it'll be a big thing. But it's absolutely fascinating from that side, where we're just learning constantly about what this product's going to give us and do for our golfers.
Yeah. Well, I also love the price point. Like, I really can't say that enough. And I'm curious about that, because there are, I imagine, many reasons and many ways to go about setting a price for something. How do you land on $199 for a product like that?
Yeah, that's...
So there's certain things that we'll look at in terms of, you know, try to make a certain margin, et cetera, on each product. But ultimately, we're not there to overcharge golfers. I think we believe, none of our products have subscriptions. So we definitely believe nothing should have a subscription tied to it. And then it's really a case of saying, well, what do we think the market will show us? And we're much rather look at a quantity over quality, or we'd rather sell more at a slightly less price than maybe the sort of, you can see the old MBA chart and graph that says, well, your pricing should be here. But we see this as an opportunity to help golfers and grow our brand. And if we can sell 100,000 LM1s a year, well, there's 100,000 golfers that have been exposed to ShotScope as a brand and ultimately come into our ecosystem, understand all the other products that we do, but ultimately hopefully improve their golf game. You know, maybe they go and read one of our ebooks, and then they talk about it at the weekend, say, I was on ShotScope and I was reading this, and suddenly there's three more golfers that they played with have then heard about our brand. So it's a big mix of things that go into pricing, but we're generally relatively affordable. I think we provide great value across our products at the pricing, and we don't want to nickel and dime golfers, right? Golf's pretty expensive as it is. We just want golfers to improve.
I think relatively is an incredibly conservative approach to where you guys stand. I think one thing that I've always noticed about ShotScope is it's incredibly competitive on the price scale. And it's also something that I don't think the returns are diminishing at all. I think they're actually incredibly valuable. When you buy the products, I think the ecosystem point was an incredibly interesting one, because, you know, kicking and screaming last year, I put quite a few months into the V3, and I noticed it wasn't just an on-course production. Getting home and reviewing my round and finally getting enough numbers to analyze my failures and my successes, and seeing things like what clubs perform the best off which tee boxes. There is so much that goes into that secondary component of ShotScope that it's only natural that a person who uses it is going to find out. And I think that's a really good thing. So I'd love to tie the LM1 conversation into that, because I've seen the value from the V3 of using your online tools and the information that comes with that. So the incorporation of the LM1 seemed to be an incredibly natural and logical thing to bring that into your online profile, to be able to generate a bunch of numbers. I'd love to know more about how that's going to work for golfers and what that means, because there are lots of guys out there who are familiar with over obsessing their their ShotScope data at this point.
So at the moment, LM1, you can go and upload your sessions. So one of the things that we do in the LM1 is we'll say, hey, where are you? Are you on a course? Are you doing a practice session? And then you can go and upload that. And you can start to look at some of your trends. It launches tomorrow, so you'll be able to delete shots from that session. But effectively review those practice sessions. Look at some of your speed training if you're doing that. See some of those averages, some of those tendencies with clubs. That's where we're at the moment. The flip side of this is we own every part of our ecosystem. So does that mean that you could go, if you take the H50, you can manually input your distances from the app, your tendencies into that, and it will give you club suggestions and understanding, personalized, effectively course map planner. We're still trying to figure out how we tie the two sides of this a little bit more together. But ultimately, again, because we own all of this, we'll be able to do that. And in reality, that's where I think the team is very good at, is they're able to come along and go, let's get it out. We know we've got all this functionality, which I think makes it a great product. But I tell you what,
maybe in 4 or 5 months when we've got some opinions and reviews from our users, hey, we could go and add some other features in or some ability to cross collab or take all of your LM1 data, maybe use it on my strategy, whatever that may be, which will further enhance product value effectively. And I think we need to do a good job of that across all of our products.
There is an absurd amount of data collection that goes on with ShotScope. You know, a lot of the units that you have an incredible benefit of being able to understand how golfers apply their data or how they play the golf course. I think more importantly, I'm really curious, and I'd imagine a lot of people are, when you go through these sessions and review the user data, how does that help you build out future state projects and components that really fortify the story?
Yeah. So we do that at different times of the year. We'll go and look at it. So we have constantly a team in here that's building data content, which is fascinating because, you know, Jen's in there. So obviously Jen's well known in the forum. She's constantly coming up and seeing ideas and opportunities within our data, things that we want. So one of the things we're looking at the moment is, for our watches, is there another way to do pin collect? So we've got a couple of ideas. So again, that's been brought out of Jen saying, hey, we think we should have some more guys doing pin collect than what we are. How can we look at this and kind of working it through? And then it diverges, I suppose, at that point as well, because you have the software side of the business. And hey, here's a gap. So we have a gap. I can talk about it. So we have a thing coming out called ShotScope Sixes. And it's going to come out at the end of next month, where Jen's been working with the data team saying, actually, when we're going away and analyzing, and of course, ahead of like a Tracker Championship, we do analyze after the data experience for golfers. So actually, it'd be great. And it constantly comes down to 6 metrics. Let's take that and try to provide a little bit of a different insight to golfers. So that's a softer thing. Now, we've made it into a system, I suppose, that's going to help golfers get some more insight. But our team's constantly looking at those. And what's fascinating now is we're now looking at, across launch monitors and stuff, is how could you take your on-course data, feed that into a launch monitor for off-course understanding, or maybe to enhance how you practice, mm-hmm. how you make the most of that 30-minute session. So there's the amount of ideas that float around this office of how a golfer can improve is unbelievable. And I do a really good job at avoiding a lot of those meetings at the moment, which is great. But like the sixes, so the sixes will come out at the end of April. Jen's then going to look at a pre-Trackers Championship for the 4 guys that are there and do an analysis using the sixes. And that'll then form quite a bit of that week or a couple of days with them at Arbor discussing those elements. So it all ties in, which is great. And therefore, suddenly the THP community through the trackers will understand sixes and the benefit of those 6 metrics and what we're looking for, how they impact your wider golf game. And that all came from some analysis about 2 years ago of looking through what we're providing the ecosystem. So it's a fascinating company to be involved with because of that constant sort of dedication to improvement. And it can be software, it can be hardware, it can be new products, it can be older products that are getting a firmware update and what that provides.
Wow. Are there, you mentioned pin collect being a challenge, and I'm curious, are there a couple things about the data collection that you are focused on or you consider challenges right now?
Yeah, I mean, so we took the decision about 4 years ago that we would look at multiple different ways to track your game into our ecosystem. So you have your watches with automatic, i.e. the tags are in there and the watches are sensing. You then have the H50 and the Kinect, which is more of a tap, a manual system. You're then going to have, sorry, that was the H4 and the Kinect, and then H50, you're going to have a manual input. So there are no tags involved. So we've been trying to come up with different ways in to suit different golfers. Now, there's a real understanding that whilst in the UK, watches are the most commonly used DMD, that's not the case in the US. So it's hard enough in the US to get a golfer to wear a watch, let alone to wear a watch that then tracks as well. So we've got all of that going on, and there's an element of refining each of those products and each of those types of tracking methods or collection methods. And then there's wider discussions of going, okay, I can understand the benefits of what tracking your game does for you. You'll understand the benefits of what tracking your game does for you. It's very niche for something that can improve a golfer very quickly and for relatively low cost compared to what you would go and spend on a new driver that will increase 4 yards of distance and therefore make you score slightly better. It's very niche to the golf market to be an active tracker and investing the time. So we're having a wider look at what does tracking look like in 2, 5, and 10 years? What would it have to go? Is there a way you could turn up at a golf course, play, finish, and it would tell you every single shot you took, what club you used, how far you hit it from the flag, and give it all and require no editing and was absolutely perfect? Well, if you could do that, every golfer in the world would track.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
I was going to say that there is a third component to this, and it's the level of humility required to have that data available, right? Like,
yes.
I always joked about the best golfer is the one with an incredibly short memory. so that is another component to it. But I do think you're right. If it's handed to you on a silver platter like that, yeah, I think the majority of golfers would be curious to know.
I mean, I to your point, I used to joke. So obviously played golf professionally for 5 years. And I think you either have to be a bit of an idiot or super smart. And they're the successful ones. And the ones in the middle really struggle. They're the ones that stay awake at night and think about all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of these things where we've done a great job as a company of, having that ecosystem and tracking and game improvement, but also being able to branch out on other products that sit alone, that ultimately will help a golfer improve, but they talk to the market. They talk to the market in terms of a want. They work for retail. They work across different territories in the world, which has given us an expanse and a platform that we can go and invest money in tracking, because we really believe that tracking is where golf will be in 5-10 years. But it needs investment and it needs time and thinking and understanding of the electronic capability and what's coming out, what's new that will be there.
Yeah, I want to add a little bit of personal experience, and I do think we need to talk H50. But part of this is the first time we've talked since I really spent any time tracking, and I think there needs to be a bit of a celebration on the process works. I was never critical of it. I was always just concerned that I play golf for the next shot, not the shot before it, and I was always worried, like, would that have a negative impact on me when I knew that I couldn't just walk away from a shot that I'd hit. Right? It was always going to be there. I found the post-round analysis to be incredibly therapeutic. I did not expect that at all. I thought it'd be a real challenge for me. But we as golfers have the uncanny ability to remember every shot we hit that day. And last week, frankly, there was a couple. I waited a week and then did it, and I could still do it just fine. I remembered exactly where the pin was, the putts, making those subtle changes, because you know, GPS has an interesting way about it that it likes to wander a little bit sometimes, which is fine. What I was really surprised about, and I'll go back to it, was that therapeutic component of feeling finalized on my round and then being able to recollect and to dictate what I needed to focus on moving forward. I was blown away at how impactful just posting that round was. And I didn't have to wait the 20 rounds to get a real baseline on my numbers. It was like, next time I go out there, especially if the pin's in this place, I need to think about it in a little bit of a different way. And it's a bit easier for me because I play the same course most of the time. But my thought process when I'm out there changes based on where the pin locations are. And once you start to get a little conditioning there, once you get a little repetition on what you're applying, I was really surprised at how much it allowed me to course manage off the course as well as on it.
Fascinating. And what element of your game do you think it's helped the most?
That's a great question. I think tee selection was a really curious one. I've been pretty notoriously honest about how bad my long game's been, but as I incorporate a driver through it in a hybrid again, whereas like a driver 1-iron, 3-iron for a long time, having the chance to go and look at those tee shots that I was hitting and putting myself in certain numbers and being able to compare those numbers to situations where I was further back in percentages of greens, I thought was really fascinating. That was something that I got very comfortable in playing the course in a very specific way because I play it so much. Not only that, but changing tees, it helped me to understand where those impacts would be most problematic or beneficial for me to have certain clubs in my hand. And I'll give you a good example. The fourth hole at my golf course is a par five with a wall of trees in the middle of it. And, you know, I'd always played a specific club off the tee, but then we started mixing tees up a little bit. So I was playing different clubs and I got to experience that second shot into a par five, the results of those and the impact of my score based on the tee ball I would hit and the clubs I was using on the hole. I could really see how impactful that would be on my scores.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. I mean, yeah. I think tee shots is one of the main elements where you can go, okay, a lot of it is just decisions. Balls in hand. It's how do you see a hole? What are you going to do? And I generally think, you know, we've looked at quite a few things internally where it's, yeah, driver distance is great, but it's actually, what is your average tee shot distance on par fours and par fives around that course? How aggressive are you off that course? And it's amazing what the slightly more aggressive people can do in terms of scoring. And mm-hmm. It's amazing how somebody can suddenly be 25 yards on average ahead of the other golfer because they decide to hit a couple of irons off tees. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I think, you know, we battle with it quite a lot internally where we'll build ebooks and advice and our blog, and it's great. And I think golfers can learn a huge amount reading this type of content, but it doesn't compare to sort of your individual characteristics and your individual understanding of your game. You know, when you've tracked 25 rounds and you can look at a portfolio of data and start to gain insights left, right, and center.
Yeah. I'd be curious. The one part that I thought was not added that I had to use my own experience with was the added stress levels of, let's say, going hitting driver off a tee and having to like work a ball into a green for a second shot opportunity, but the green isn't particularly approachable, so there's a higher rate of risk involved with that. That was the one thing that I'm going to pay attention to more this year, is reflecting on the challenges. And because I like to stay pretty level when I play golf, I don't like the ups and downs. As boring as it sounds, like 18 par is probably the safest way for me to play golf. I'm like a six bogeys, six birdies kind of guy. So that component was a really curious one to me. It was like, I'm not really seeing the stress level, but you also get the average score based on the T-ball. So it's like, I feel like it's already pretty applicable. And then I can sort of relate it to the next hole. Like, how did I play the next two holes after taking that chance, right? Adding some stress to my game. So, you know, those are the things I was really surprised that that really got my head going. And I feel like most of the time, the conversations on THP are incredibly curious because a lot of people look at these things differently. And to your point, you have a pretty good idea what you're going to do. It's not as easy to look at someone else's data and come to the same conclusions, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah, let's talk H50 a little bit. I know we're stretching a little bit long, but I feel like it is a critical piece of the 2026 conversation. Why does H50 matter? Where did that come about?
So it's the product that we've been consistently asked for the most. A sort of large GPS with full course maps. And so we were constantly asked about this from different retailers, from different users. And then, you know, we've got a wide variety of golfers in here. And I had an incident a couple of years ago at a course in Orlando where I was like, hey, I think this hole's straight. Hit it over this sort of brow of this hill. Turns out it wasn't. It was straight right, dog leg. I think I cleared the house. I don't know where the ball finished. But I looked at the wrong hole in the scorecard and made a decision and off you go. And you're like, yeah, you know what? There's something there. So we have also been able to upgrade our own course mapping to be able to provide the courses on the maps, how on the device, how we want. And the thing that's caught us off guard with it is how many people want to shot track on it. We wanted to have some type of capability. But again, it's interesting. So I've been playing with this for about 6 weeks now. I use that and a rangefinder on the course. I like the combo. And ultimately, I think it'll be an incredibly good product for us. That multi-usability, whether you want to put it in your pocket, use the magnet, put it onto your golf cart, or for instance, I use an electric trolley, so I've got a little holder where I can put it in there and it just sits in front of me the whole time and shows me the hole. Adding in green maps was a step further, again, of us working on our course mapping. And ultimately, just a really nice product. And again, good value. $199 is you know, pretty strong value there. And yeah, fascinated to see where that one takes us. It's not going to get the hype that the LM1 gets, right? And we've had to take it to market very differently, launching 10 days before the LM1. But yeah, response has been very good so far.
You know, I think it's interesting you say that because, at least from my perspective, this is how I got started playing tracking golf and distance tracking golf. So, you know, I had a pay for service, which I tried to use numerous times after and just got too irritated by the yearly fee and gave up on it. But you know, my course management started with a 100, 150, 200 yard marker. I make the assumption based on that. Then I joined a course that had sprinkler heads with distances to front, middle, back. And then I got started with this, this digital device that I could pick a spot and it would tell me how far I could hit to there and then what it would be to the green from that point. So from a course management perspective, I look at this and it's like, this is allowing you to take your data and apply it to your tee shot preparations for every hole you play. I feel like this is the storyline for me is you're a ShotScope user, you know where your strengths lie, and you mentioned incorporating some of that information into it, which I think is wild. But now you can set it up on the tee, like, hey, if I hit to here, what do I have into the green? That's the real conversation for me. So from a handheld GPS standpoint, I think this is incredible, especially at the price point. You mentioned that you use a rangefinder as well. Can I assume that's for your approach shots more than anything else?
Yeah, when I get with maybe 175 yards and then the flip side, so again, becomes personal, right? So I played professionally. It was a yardage book and a pin map. So again, I was said to the guys when we were building it, hey, when we get within 100 yards, just let's just show what the pin map would be. So it'll show you sort of 10 yards in from the back and 8 yards in from the right. I'm like, that's great information. So, and then I can move that flag about to where it is on the green, and suddenly it's all there in front of me. Do I really need a rangefinder? Couple of rounds, I've not used one at all. But it's a nice backup to have just to work it out. You know, and you can dovetail them. The thing with the H50 is there's so much in it, that capability to go and set it up so it'll show you, instead of showing you 200 yards, 250 yards off the tee, you can have exactly your driver distance numbers pulled through. If you're a tracker online, it'll do it automatically. You can also punch it into the system. You can, ultimately, you can keep score for your grip. It's almost a bit of an in-cart GPS in places as well. So yeah, it's a fascinating product, and I think it's the total opposite from the LM1. The LM1 is simple and it is what it is, and it's just does exactly what required, and here's this H50 that does everything and is a fascinating sort of product and adds a ton of value.
Yeah. I can't imagine this doesn't sell like crazy once people realize all that it encompasses. And frankly, golfers should be frustrated because you're showing what you can get for $200, under $200. And we've paid a lot of money for things like this in the past that come with additional fees. So, you know, I think anyone paying attention, even a little bit, should be curious about this. I know I got a buddy who gave up on rangefinders because he felt like it was too precise and uses a front, middle, back. I'm going to send him this link the second we get off this recording, because I feel like he's going to buy it immediately. It's funny, man, that you guys are really refining the story for a lot of golfers in various ways. And I think that's great because it can all roll up to your ecosystem, the shot tracking information, whether you're applying it yourself or whether you're pulling it from the tracking softwares, the tracking elements that you have. I think that's really cool. I'm thrilled to see what you guys are coming up with this year. It's cool.
No, I appreciate that. Well, you need to get yourself to Arbor.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Arbor is that is a bucket list golf course for me, man. That you guys, so you were at Hidden Creek 2 years ago, is that right?
We've been to Ballyhack, Hidden Creek, Victoria National.
Vic.
So we're just doing the rounds.
Yeah. I've played everyone but Arbor on your list. Okay. I loved Hidden Creek. Ballyhack is a trip. Victoria, I got to get you back on. There's too much going on with ShotScope. We don't have you on enough. We got to get you back on just to talk about golf courses alone. Tell me, what was your favorite that you've played so far?
Out of those four, or just in general?
No. Out of the Dormy courses you've played.
Out of the Dormy ones. I really enjoyed the front nine at Ballyhack and the back nine at Victoria National.
You just like pain, right?
So yeah, I do, right? Which is sadistic. And you know, get me off the back tees and let's see how hard it can be.
Wow.
So yeah. Hidden was really nice, and it really like that type of golf where it's in the trees. It was too wide for me.
Well, it felt a little comfortable, felt a little happy, right?
a little bit. Whereas, you know, I like the sort of moments from sort of the cliff edge and falling over to your death sort
sure.
of golf course.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple more I think you'd really enjoy. I'll tell you what, can we do something a little bit fun maybe later on in the summer? Have you back on. I'll be tracking my data. We can maybe do a little deep dive and talk some smack about what I'm doing. And absolutely. Then we can talk about dormy courses as well.
Sounds like an absolute plan. Good
cool.
for that.
Hey, well, I appreciate you coming on, man. LM1 looks insane. H50 is going to be in a lot of bags, or I suppose hanging from a lot of carts here pretty soon. Congrats on these ideas. We're incredibly excited, and by we, I mean the community. to see your growth and the change of shots go past. It's awesome.
No, look, it's funny. Jen and I are active, so active in the community just because we enjoy it. It's not really ShotScope related. It's more just the interaction. And everybody's very positive. So we appreciate the feedback, especially when it's good and bad, because it lets us grow. So, but yeah, look, really excited. And I sort of joke that, you know, I got a couple of small kids, but, you know, that dormy network couple of days with some of the guys, like, it's probably the most golf I play, you know, in sort of 36 hours. And yeah, just enjoy that sort of weekend. And it's all good fun. So really enjoy the support and happy to have that support from THP.
Awesome. Well, that's happening middle of May, I believe. So have a great time at Arbor.
Yeah, it is middle of May. So, you know, Jen's been practicing hard. he needs to win one.
Fair warning to the folks out there on Team Gavin. Have fun, and yeah, we'll be chatting with you pretty soon.
Sounds good. Cheers.
All right. Hey, everyone out there, if you're playing golf this weekend, have fun, and don't waste an opportunity to track your data. I've been critical about the process of tracking before based on personal experiences, but over the last year, I've spent quite a bit of time with it, and I've had a lot of fun. So don't be afraid to dive in. At the end of the day, you can hide all the data to yourself. You can delete whatever the hell you want. No, who cares? But check out some of these new products from ShotScope. They look awesome. We'll see you guys next week. Now it's time to send it over to Don Brown for this week's Shaft Education, brought to you by True Temper.
Hey everybody, Shaft University on the road this week, out on our tour truck in San Diego, answering your questions. This week's question is, can we make a shaft that's adaptable to different swing speeds? I assume this question means, like, if you're cold one day versus hot and your swing speed changes a little, can the shaft adapt to that? There are some materials out there that can do this. The problem is using them in concert with graphite prepreg. Graphite is so stiff that you can put things into it like a super elastic titanium or maybe a viscoelastic material. But in general, the carbon fiber prepreg is going to overpower that material and you won't see a ton of the benefits. So answer is really no. We don't have anything yet that will adapt to a big variation in swing speed depending on how you're swinging that day. Hope that helps. Talk to you guys next week. Hey THP fam, another episode of Shaft University coming at you. This week's question is about hoop stiffness and how it affects feel. And that's a great question with our new Titan shaft launching. Hoop stiffness is how much the shaft ovalizes when you swing. If you think about a shaft as a circle, when it bends, it becomes an oval. That energy is lost, and it makes the shaft feel softer than it may actually play based on its EI profile. With our new Sinex technology that we're using in Titan, we have that really soft butt section, but by wrapping the shaft with multiple layers of off-axis fiber, we increase the hoop stiffness. The result? A shaft that's about 10 cycles softer than what a traditional shaft would be at that flex that actually feels a little bit firmer. So that's how hoop stiffness comes into play. The more hoop stiffness, the firmer the shaft is going to feel based on its EI profile. Hope that answers your question. You guys will see that in action on Titan. Go out and try that today. Hey everybody, Don Brown from True Temper, back with another episode of Shaft University, sitting on our tour truck today, parked here in San Diego. This week's question is about fiber angle and how that affects playability of the shaft. So we talk about 0-degree fibers, that is stiffness. So those flags run the full length, or sometimes we'll put them just in the tip, mid, butt section, wherever we're trying to stiffen the shaft up. We also use 45 degree flags. That's how we control torque. So that fiber is running around the shaft at a 45 degree angle. We can again place that specifically in certain places in the shaft, maybe like with our frost technology that we use on the Denali frost, where we're trying to improve the torsional stiffness in certain locations. We use a lot of other fiber angles. You'll hear us talk about 90 degree or our new Sinex technology, which uses a bunch of different fiber angles to create hoop stiffness. That's how we can create a softer handle on a shaft like Titan that doesn't feel like it plays softer. So we can take the same fibers and rotate them around the shaft to get different playability functions, but usually what we're doing is we're just changing the fiber angle within one flag. So a lot of our shafts, 17, 20, 25 flags. So it's really about adjusting the fiber angle within specific flags and certain sections on the shaft. Hope that answers your question. Talk to you guys next time. Hey everybody, Don Brown back here with another episode of Shaft University. This week's question is about the Titan line and if we're only going to have a black profile and if we're boxed in by that unique EI profile that the Titan Black has. The answer is no, we're not boxed in. We can definitely make other profiles. We can alter the launch conditions by changing the other flags in the shaft, not up at the butt end where we have that soft handle. Will we have other models? Technically, I'm not supposed to tell you, but I'm the boss, so I will at least say you probably bet on it. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next time.
THP Radio on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network, your number one source for all things golf. Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.